Greetings, podcast fans. This is the Internet Monk, Michael Spencer, podpastering for you today almost live from lovely Legends Field in Tampa, Florida, where the 9-2-1 spring training version of the Cincinnati Reds once again goes up against the epitome of evil, the New York Yankees. This is the voice of post-evangelicals everywhere, a voice of sanity in the midst of the ever-growing evangelical circus. This is Internet Monk Radio, podcast number 50. Take your steps and your dress to please, but you close your eyes. An absolutely gorgeous day here in southeastern Kentucky. It's 80 degrees, clear. My son is home. Got to see my daughter first of the week. My wife is off work. We're traveling the end of the week to Louisville to see a play. Stay at the Legacy Center there at Southern's campus. Everything is perfect except there's no baseball anywhere. Our high school team is not here. The Legends are not in Lexington. Everything is just perfect for a baseball game. And all the baseballs are going on down in Florida, where I can't believe it's any nicer than it is here. So other than that, perfect, perfect week. Hey, I got something I want you to hear. My good friend Joel Hunter is up at St. Mindred, which is a seminary and monastery in southern Indiana, one of my favorite places in the world. I go there and hang out whenever I have the opportunity. And he sent me a little MP3 of the monks singing early one morning. This is probably about 7 in the morning. And I want to play some of this for you. It's just gorgeous. It's not chanting. It's the monks singing a little choral piece. And the volume's pretty low and the quality's not that great, but I'm going to try to boost it up for you. This is the monks of St. Mindred singing, and Joel Hunter recorded it for me. Well, I really hope you were able to hear that because it's beautiful. I want to thank Joel for making that recording. It makes me kind of homesick for St. Meinrad, which is definitely one of the special places in the world for me. Thomas Merton, in his book, Seven Story Mountain, romanticized monasticism to a degree that was, of course, exaggerated. Merton himself critiqued that and ran pretty far away from it. But he says a lot of things in his early books. Sign of Jonas is one I think about, where it's sort of a journal of his early years. And he talked about the beauty and the mystery of men who get up in the middle of the night to sing the Psalms and chant the Psalms and pray for the world. And as I've been more studious about liturgy in the last couple of years, as I've been on my own post-evangelical journey, the idea of our duty to pray for the world as Christians, these little gathered groups of people, wherever they happen to be, praying not just for, you know, grandma in the hospital, which is a worthy prayer request, of course, but praying for the world, praying for suffering, praying for mercy, praying for the outpouring of the Holy Spirit, praying for the big stuff, you know, the thy kingdom come things. It is really easy for me to get quite moved when I have been at Meinrad and I am there in the early hours, the 5 a.m. or the 7 or whatever it happened to be, and they're chanting the Psalms and they're praying for the world. And I think what a really awesome thing it is that there is a place where this is going on. And it's so odd that when I talk about monasticism and my experience of it, which is mainly going just on retreats. I mean, I'm not some sort of a junior monk. I want you to know that, you know, I go for 2 or 3 days and keep the schedule as best I can. I don't get up at 3. But I spend a lot of time in the library. But I try to do what is appropriate for a spiritual retreat. When I share this with people, they go, well, what a waste of time. Just think of all the good they could be doing. And if there is one thing that it saddens me to realize is that for so many of us in evangelicalism, those guys praying the Psalms and praying for the world in the night while the world is sleeping and the world is fighting and the world is doing its thing, for most evangelicals, that is a waste of time. That is how little the whole God-centered, God-saturated aspect of prayer registers with them. And they very quickly say, well, think of all you could be doing. Well, think of all you could be doing if you took down your $200,000 audiovisual system. Think of all you could be doing with the incredible salaries you pay. I mean, these are questions we need to ask ourselves. And I mean, if you want to ask them of people who are devoting their lives to prayer in monasteries and convents, that's fine too. And I'm not here to try to say that we need anything approaching, you know, a kind of monasticism. But I do see the new monasticism growing up out of a lot of different kinds of soil. And one of the kinds of soil it's growing out of is a sort of spiritual discontent with just how spiritually bankrupt, how spiritually poor evangelicalism is in things like the reading of the scriptures and the praying of the scriptures and praying for the world and being in that same sort of posture towards the world and towards God that you see in monasticism. So thank you, Joel, and I hope that pretty soon I can get up there to St. Meinrad again. And if you're in that area, go over and spend some time with those good folks. They have a beautiful guest house. It's not free. They have all the really nice facilities for a superb personal retreat. And they have some retreat schedules there. You can go to, I believe it's stmeinrad.edu and see what they've got going on. Well, I believe today is the day we're going to finish our Bible study in Romans chapter 15. 1-7. If you've been with me on the last 3 podcasts, we've taken part of this passage and we've talked about it. It's a passage that has a lot to say to the subject of Christian community, but it talks about other things as well. I think that if you are a preacher or a teacher, You have probably read through it and said, you know, there's a lot of things here that I can work with. I have enjoyed it. Romans 15, starting at verse 5. May the God of endurance and encouragement grant you to live in such harmony with one another in accord with Christ Jesus, that together you may with one voice glorify the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, welcome one another as Christ has welcomed you for the glory of God. When I look at the way this passage ends, there are a couple of things that my eyes are drawn to. One is that you have an ending, which is sort of a prayer ending, asking God to do something. And normally when you're writing something and you come to an ending, you ask for big things, and you're asking here for God to grant harmony and unity in Jesus Christ. But then there's a therefore in verse 7 on the other side of that big request, and the therefore is something very practical. Therefore, welcome one another as Christ has welcomed you for the glory of God. Welcoming. There's a word that embodies so much of the gospel, and I hope that we're hearing it as being more than just let's welcome people at the front door of the church, which, of course, there's nothing wrong with that. But to welcome someone is to include them within community on some level, to say it's appropriate that you're here. It's not inappropriate. You're not a stranger. You're not excluded. It's not inappropriate for you to be here. But welcome one another. And that welcoming one another is apparently an ongoing, God-glorifying expression of our overall unity and harmony in Jesus Christ. Welcoming one another is the continual work of the Christian community. And by that, I hope we won't get into a kind of cul-de-sac and say, well, what we need to do is to find who are the really sensitive people who constantly feel excluded and left out, and let's make sure that we all serve them in such a way that they never, ever feel excluded. You know, there are people whose entire approach to any community relationship is to kind of dominate it by their constantly being offended and constantly being left out. And, well, you know, I'm not really accepted. And that's a difficult thing within community, because what somebody's doing is they're taking a legitimate need, an important aspect of being community and relating to each other, and they're using it as a way to gain power over others. They're using it as a way to manipulate. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about looking at each person and saying, you know, Jesus included this person despite their flaws. He included them on the basis of his own grace, his gracious invitation to this person to come to his table, his gracious inclusion of this person in his work on the cross is the basis on which I genuinely welcome this person into the community. But of course, welcome is also a matter of rejoicing that someone's there, and not just saying, well, you know, here's your seat, but it is good that you are here. It's good that you're part of this community. It's good that God has created you. God has made you. God has brought you here. You have gifts to offer. Just your personhood is a gift to this community. And the glory of God is in some way seen in your unique participation, in your unique part of partnership in this community in a way it's not seen in anyone else. Therefore, welcome one another as Christ has welcomed you is, of course, built on the same sort of logic as forgive one another and as Christ has forgiven you and other New Testament statements. And it's not only a word for the community of the church, but it's a word for the community of marriage, where people feel excluded and estranged all the time, and for families. Particularly, I think about extended families. I had some examples recently of the kind of grudges and bitterness that can divide families that ought to be held together by the fact that they do love one another and belong to one another in a deep bond. But it just becomes real hard work to welcome another person into your space, into your life. into that part of your world where you feel only comfortable with those you love and who love you. Jesus' constant command for us to be welcoming one another and to welcome people is very challenging. It's not just challenging with strangers, it's challenging with those we're most familiar with. And so I hope you'll see this relationship between verses 5 and 6 and 7, that asking for this big thing of, okay, God, give us harmony, give us one accord, give us unity, help us with one voice to glorify and rejoice in you. These are images that my mind goes to. The community gathered in heaven, worshiping together, singing together, shouting out the praises of God, those sort of eschatological imagery. But in the here and now, it's a matter of welcoming one another as Jesus welcomed you. And I'm really intrigued by the way that in verse 7 and in verse 6, you have references to the glory of God. Together with one voice, glorify God, and then welcome one another for the glory of God. We have in evangelicalism today a sort of idea of, okay, let's go in and sing some praise music and that glorifies God. And then you say, all right, what about our relationships with these people? How about including and welcoming people as Jesus did? That also glorifies God. We do it for the glory of God. Verse 7 is one of those verses that remind us that there's almost nothing that can be excluded from what we do for the glory of God. Let me just mention one other thing as we finish up this Bible study in Romans chapter 15. I think Jesus' inclusion of people in his community goes far beyond what most of us ever conceive of as being the kind of welcome we ought to give. And I say this as a challenge. I think there are there's some new thinking going on among missional Christians and emerging Christians about just where is this boundary. You know, there's obviously a confessional boundary, a baptismal boundary with the people of God. But when we think about the kind of table fellowship that Jesus created and the kind of fellowship he created going into people's homes and including people who were sinners and tax collectors and the Pharisees, his table fellowship with them, I think it tells us that there's a level of fellowship that ought to happen in the Christian community that eagerly welcomes and includes those who are not there at that boundary of baptism or confession yet. And sometimes I'm amazed at how people get all worked up about this when I say, okay, welcome the person with AIDS, welcome the homosexual, welcome the person who is not there yet of giving their lives to Christ and who may be actually in a very different place. Welcoming one another is obviously a command for those within the confessional baptismal boundaries of the community. But is it any less a command for those who are not there yet, but for whom we have the opportunity to share a table or a meal or to bring them together with us or to go to where they are? And that's pretty powerful. You know, I think welcoming people who feel like they are going to be excluded by the fact that they have a tattoo or they're divorced or they have a criminal record or their husband is in prison, or they've struggled with a drug dependency, or they've done some immoral thing. Those people don't feel like they're welcomed, and they don't feel like anybody wants to welcome them. So when we do welcome them, it's a powerful statement of the gospel. Do it for the glory of God. Don't just do it. Do it in a way of Jesus imitating inclusion, but do it for his glory. Romans 15, 1 through 7. I've really enjoyed this, and we'll pick another passage in couple of podcasts and we'll do some similar Bible study. My time is getting short here. It's Tuesday afternoon, which means that at 5 o'clock I'm going to be on Sirius Radio 159, the Catholic Guy program with Lino Ruli. I have a segment that I do every week with him on that program. If you've got Sirius Radio, hope that you will tune in. Just a couple of things from the website, and then we'll get out of here. I just put up a post today about women, particularly women writers in evangelicalism. And my contention is that they're way underappreciated and underrepresented, and that if you just looked at things from the standpoint of the books we read and the books we write and the books we publish, and the way we promote women's books and the way we package them, you see some things that I don't think are really very good. You see some some not so subtle messages about, I think, the competence and giftedness of women, and you kind of have this message that, well, women really don't have anything to say that a man would find valuable or find helpful. Read that post. It's called "Are We Afraid of Women and Their Cute Pink Books?" And make sure you go down the bottom of that post, and Adam Ochuk, one of the BHT fellows, has got a selection of book covers from recent books published by women authors in evangelicalism, and I think promoted within that women's market. Very interesting. If you just look graphically and say, what's the message here? What is the message here? And all of this is prompted by a book that I am reading called The Beautiful Ache by Lee McElroy. You might want to do an Amazon search on that book. Really a great book. And I'm wondering, is it packaged for all of us to read, or is it kind of being packaged and promoted for women to read? And is there sort of a separate humanness? This is a week and on the blog. This is a week that on the blogosphere, there's been all this talk about John MacArthur's challenge that any self-respecting Calvinist should also be a dispensational premillennialist. And that seems to me to be particularly the kind of thing that men like to argue about, men like to debate about. And it just strikes me that we exclude an awful lot of things whenever that is our concerns. And I implicate myself in this. Don't think I'm trying to get off the hook. But there are whole realms of human experience, an interpersonal experience, whole realms of feelings and subjectivity, and a lot of issues that, you know, where men actually wind up messing up relationships, and men wind up messing up families, and men wind up messing up churches, because we're so incompetent in some of these areas where we assume that women are competent. But of course, women don't lead in many of those areas in evangelicalism. And I'm wondering if they even contribute in ways that men have any respect for. I ask in this initial post, do you read books by women? Are there any books by women that have been vitally influential and helpful in your own spiritual development? I'm not sure there are many. There are some. And there are a lot of women in other faith traditions who've written great stuff. But evangelicalism does seem to kind of have a thing for those cute pink books, with the exception of, you know, maybe a Nancy Piercy, a Lauren Winter. There are some people who are out of that mold, and I'm grateful for them. But tell me what you think. Read that post, and maybe you make a comment. I'd love for it to stir up some conversation. Well, this is the Internet Monk, Michael Spencer, and this has been Internet Monk Radio, podcast number 50. I've enjoyed spending some time with you. And in about a week, when the Reds are, let's see, maybe about 14-3, we'll see you on the next podcast. So until then, I'll see you.